Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 25th of April, 2012, across the international dateline here in Japan, but over in America, it's still the 24th of April, and I'm honored to be joined on the line once again by Joseph Trento of DCBureau.org. Joseph Trento, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, I wanted to talk about a very fascinating article that you recently released on DCBureau.org called United States Circumvented Laws to Help Japan Accumulate Tons of Plutonium, that goes into a very interesting and long suppressed history of the Japanese nuclear program and what it was really doing behind the scenes, unbeknownst to the Japanese public. Tell us about this article.
Well, we had at the National Security News Service, which is sort of military side of our operation, our nonprofit operation, it started looking into this as early as 1991 and started doing Freedom Information Act requests, interviewing people and trying to examine exactly what the relationship was. 5 or 6 years earlier, a number of things happened during the Reagan administration, which were suspicious to say the least. And I had talked to some sources on Capitol Hill who told me that numerous American laws have been violated because there was an effort to actually transfer massive amounts of nuclear technology to Japan. And this all involved the U.S. effort to create a breeder reactor. In this case, it was the Clinch River breeder reactor. And this reactor was supposed to be the end-all of completing the nuclear fuel cycle. Unfortunately, the United States had spent about $20 billion, almost the same amount we spent going to the moon, to try and get this to work, and we could never get it to work. Congress was fed up with it. The Reagan administration wanted to keep it going. So they worked out a program to actually turn it over to Japan, and that's what they did. There was two key figures, Ambassador Richard T. Kennedy, who was a very tough bureaucratic infighter, and James Auer, who was a very sort of a Japanophile, very interested in Japan. He was a naval officer, spent a long time there. And these two men spent a good deal of effort and time trying to make it possible to turn this technology over to Japan in the hopes that Japan could actually perfect what we could not.
Well, tell us more about the psychology involved there, because obviously Japan, a nation scarred by the only nuclear weapons to be dropped in wartime, perhaps you can talk about that and how that plays into this story.
Well, I mean, the Japanese governments had always had an interest in nuclear weapons. Even during World War II, they had this program called EFCO, which was their effort, along with some help from the Nazis, to try and develop a program. They were very sophisticated scientists. They did not have the natural resources, the uranium and so forth, in order to do it. But after the war, it became quite clear to the Japanese leadership that nuclear weapons were going to be a very important part of their defense, whether they could get the United States to put them under their umbrella or to develop them on their own if they ever had to. And what became quite clear is they just didn't trust the United States to keep them under the umbrella. And finally, they got an explicit promise from President Johnson, who agreed quite reluctantly to do this. But even with that promise, the Japanese decided that they had to have a standby nuclear program. They are essentially a non-declared nuclear state. They have not built any weapons, but they could assemble a weapon quickly if they had to. And the CIA did a number of studies on Japan and concluded in a series of them that the Japanese government could assemble a weapon within 90 days. And that was as far back as 1980. So it was quite clear that they had the capability. Now, the will to deploy is another matter. And they were quite wise politically because they had U.S. support. And the decision was, as long as we had the raw material to build a weapon, we could rely on the U.S.'s word. And if that ever changed, we could protect ourselves if we had to. What's curious about that is the United States look the other way in regards to its any radioactive material of origin coming from the United States has to go through certain procedures. All of those procedures were thrown out the window when it came to Japan. And it was decided that Japan could procure plutonium-based fuel at will. And this became a very profitable venture. Now, Jimmy Carter tried very hard to prevent this kind of proliferation from happening and put some laws into effect that were actually ignored by the Reagan administration when this was done. And this became a very big deal in the United States. There was a fight in Congress over it. And it got to the point where it was passed very cleverly on a weekend when the votes were not there to defeat it. And they got it through. And the Japanese have been collecting tons of plutonium ever since, largely through the used plutonium of other countries. The United States even got involved in the problem of figuring out how to protect these shipments, which have one of the most controversial parts of this. Greenpeace has made a great deal out of this whole issue, is that these ships that go from Europe to Japan, often in very dangerous waters, bringing this, what one ship could give you the equivalent of literally dozens of nuclear weapons. So the idea that a terrorist might attack one of these ships and try and take the weapons is a real key concern. But anyway, this was allowed to be done, and done quietly, to the point now where Japan has as much plutonium as Russia or the United States, and is fully capable of deploying nuclear weapons if it has. Here's the problem. Japan had as bad luck with the fuel cycle as the United States did. In fact, worse. They had some very serious accidents at their breeder facility. The thing the Japanese government had going for it is the Japanese media was very reluctant to report on any of this. There was not much digging done. There was not much delving done. And in fact, I had some rather unpleasant experiences with the Japanese media over the years trying to get them to do this. In 1999, we put on an event at the press club in Washington, inviting the Indian ambassador, the Japanese ambassador, and the Pakistani ambassador to talk about regional nuclear issues. And the Japanese ambassador was quite angry. I think it was his number two in command who attended, but he was quite angry that we had held this thing. And he actually walked out on the event. And the reason he walked out on the event, he said, was because we were unfairly targeting Japan. Well, we weren't. We had the other countries there. The real question is, in light of Iran's interest in procuring nuclear weapons, does the United States have any real credibility in saying you can and other countries? This raises real issues in terms of U.S. credibility in trying to stop the spread of these devices.
Well, I note that that part of this stems back to a 1980s sale of a nuclear reactor to China, which started to prompt some of these changes to the policies. Tell us about the politics of East Asia and how that plays into this.
Well, and at that time, it was the Westinghouse Corporation made a $10 billion reactor sale to China, which it was shocking at the time that this was approved. But U.S. jobs were important, and the Reagan administration was facing a terrible recession in this country, so it okayed it. And this allowed Japan to put further pressure on the United States. Look, you're providing this kind of technology to a potential enemy of Japan. What are you going to do for us? And the United States was in a very tough position. But the reality is, we could have said no. We could have said no to China. But the reality is, to keep the nuclear industry going, the only way any nuclear industry can survive is with government support. And what does that mean? It means that if you don't have a weapons program, you really can't have a nuclear power industry. So any country that has a nuclear power industry is trying to procure one, probably has a weapons industry, because financially it makes no sense to have a nuclear power industry. There's no reason to have it. It's not economic. And that's why other countries that are now going to nuclear power, for example, Saudi Arabia and other places, they're saying they need the power to procure desalinization. It takes enormous amounts of electricity to do that. The reality is, the heart of any nuclear program is a covert weapons program. And no country that has attempted to have nuclear power, with the exception of a few European countries that buy the reactors and buy the fuel from other countries, really can afford to undertake this unless they are either very unless natural resources are very difficult for them, like they are in Japan, or if they have a covert weapons program, like they do in Japan. More interestingly, the electric utilities in Japan fundamentally operate as a cartel, but it's a government-controlled cartel, as we learned after Fukushima. The idea that Japan had learned this horrible lesson, you know, 6 months before Fukushima, MOX fuel, the same stuff they've been shipping back and forth, was loaded into reactor number 3 at Fukushima. And that fuel, it's only made up a small percentage of the arrays because the reactors can't handle more than that because it burns much hotter. But that fuel, once it comes out of the reactor, after it's gone through its fuel cycle, is far more dangerous than any conventional fuel, conventional reactor fuel. It burns hotter, therefore it's more radioactive, and therefore much more dangerous. Virtually turns any site where the spent fuel is stored into a military site because it must be protected. And that's what the French government got Japan to undertake when it agreed to accept this sort of fuel. But Japan was quite comfortable with MOX fuel at that point because it had been taking the waste rods from Europe. So the reality is the Japanese leadership saw plutonium as a potential resource. And the idea that you could reprocess it and further bring down the size of the waste stream as you do that appealed to them. But they never perfected the technology. So what they ended up doing was they kept accumulating tons and tons of plutonium to the point now where it is more difficult to store it, more difficult to protect it than almost anything. And that's what they're facing. Now, here in the United States, you know, Japan is not the only foolish country that went down this road. Here in the United States, the Bush administration authorized the construction of a French-designed fuel plant for MOX fuel at the Savannah River site, based on some of the Japanese activity, actually. And that plant costs $6 billion, so forth. It has no customers, and it's years behind schedule in production. We are going to be stuck with another huge white elephant from the Department of Energy here. And the reason that the program was put through, the reason it was passed in this country, was because the facilities needed to do MOX, to make this fuel, are the same facilities you need to separate the nuclear process to make weapons. Now, in the old days, it used to be a giant canyon. At Savannah River, they were these 1,000-foot-long canyons that chemically separated plutonium from the fuel rod so it could be spun into this gray metal to be put in warheads. Today, the separation involves taking the old nuclear pits from weapons and breaking them down to make MOX fuel. But you can reverse the process once you have the facilities. So the largest component in the Department of Energy in the United States is the National Nuclear Security Administration, and their job is to make weapons, and their job is to keep the stockpile fresh. And by going along with MOX as a solution to world peace, by saying we can take all the weapons from around the world, grind up the plutonium, and make them into reactor fuel, they got what they wanted, which was money for new facilities to do this. The Japanese government will be making those kinds of decisions down the road, because the only thing else you can do with this plutonium is to suspend it in glass and bury it someplace. So what you're taking on is a waste load of very hard to get rid of material.
Well, as North Korea demonstrated in rather spectacular fashion recently, of course, the fuel is only one half of the equation when we're talking about a covert nuclear weapons program. The delivery devices are the other half. Talk about Japan's nuclear weapons delivery abilities.
Well, this is, to me, one of the most interesting things. Japan is a, you know, just has scientists and technicians who are equal to any in the world, better in some cases. But they had a great deal of trouble with their space program. The H-1 rocket and the other rockets they were trying to develop had a lot of problems, as did the U.S. program in the early days. But in the process of finally perfecting their program and getting it to a point where it could do the kind of things that they needed it to do, the Japanese made the decision that through their intelligence services, they would procure a intermediate Russian missile third stage, the bus, that actually delivers warhead. And what they procured was a very interesting item, because what they got was this MIRV item, which allows independently targetable missiles to go to a target and then split off. So, for example, if you were attacking North Korea, as just an example, you could attack three different or four different or five or six different targets at once, depending on how you configure this thing. In this case, it was three targets. That purchase moved Japan far along in the terms of delivery. But having the technology and actually building the missiles are two different things. My guess is if Japan was deploying, they would deploy some form of cruise missiles, probably something they'd buy from the United States. They wouldn't need to because an air-launched cruise missile can carry a warhead and cover the distances that would need to be needed if the Japanese were responding to an attack from, for example, North Korea.
All right, well, let's turn back to the Japanese population, because living here in Japan, I can tell you that the general public's awareness of this issue and this history is not there. Certainly, this is not a story that's really filtered down to the general public yet. In the wake of the horror of Fukushima and everything that the country has had to deal with since then, obviously, this is just another blow to the national understanding of the nuclear power industry. What do you think are the long-term consequences of this story and this hidden information coming to light?
I think the long-term consequences are the Japanese people will begin to demand more information. What's interesting about that is I've gotten a lot of calls and emails from people in Japan asking me for, you know, further information or what we could provide. But what's interesting is I haven't heard from the Japanese media. I got one very angry email from an NHK employee or somebody who said he worked for NHK, just saying that, you know, this isn't true, it couldn't be true, how dare you do this? And my response was this, that I had offered NHK this material 10 years ago, and there was no interest in it. I basically was told to get lost. Now, this is somebody who's done a number of documentaries, worked with NHK researchers on their entire 20th century documentary series. So I have some history with this organization and enormous respect for it, especially their post-Fukushima coverage, which was exceptional. But the idea of a government-controlled news entity is not the only problem here. The Japanese newspapers, almost all the media there has been reluctant to look into this. Now, there have been a number of right-wing Japanese politicians. We should go nuclear, we should do this, we should do that. And they're sort of laughed off by the mainstream media. And the truth is the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan has fundamentally, the military side of that party has fundamentally lied to the Japanese people for decades. And it's something you have to confront. I mean, our politicians lie to us all the time. It's not here in the United States. It's not quite the same in Japan. And I suspect that the Fukushima events, you know, where northern Japan essentially has become a national sacrifice zone, and if it had gotten any worse, Tokyo could have been in that zone. I think the people of Japan are going to have to start asking some very tough questions and not assume the honesty and goodwill that they've assumed in the past. It's too bad, the reason I did the story wasn't about Japan. It was about what the U.S. did to cause it and the U.S. role in proliferation, because we are sworn through a treaty called the Non-Proliferation Treaty not to do this sort of thing. And we did. And we continue to do it. And so when we tell a country that's not a particularly nice country, doesn't have a good leadership, in our view, like Iran, that they can't do something, they point to these kind of events and say, but what? You did it. And this isn't the first time we did it. I mean, Dale Armstrong and I did a book called America and the Islamic Bomb, which was how we looked the other way as Pakistan got the weapon, because Saudi Arabia was our ally and had asked us to look the other way. And they actually diverted funds that were going to the Mujahideen in the fight against the Russians into their bomb program. So we have a history of this. We allowed India to work with Israel on their bomb. The Atoms for Peace program, which was the whole idea was to spread nuclear power around the world, give everybody access to cheap powder, ended up becoming a training ground, sort of a farm team for nuclear weapons scientists. So that's why we did the stories. The idea that Japan is the only victim of these kinds of weapons is now in a position of having to face up to the fact that its governments, and it isn't one government, it's a series of governments, have done this is really something they'll have to think about and confront and decide what to do about politically. That's something I can't answer. I mean, I'm sort of disgusted with my own country's behavior, so it's hard for me to look beyond that.
Well, then, finally, let's talk about the reaction, the pushback and or feedback that you've gotten on this story in the United States.
Almost no interest in the United States. It's sort of a big yawn in the United States, to be honest with you. I mean, it's gotten, you know, retweeted and lots of likes on Facebook and the social media. But the U.S. media has no interest in the story. It's very interesting. In this country, there's a big scandal involving the Obama administration and a company called Slenderer that makes solar panels because they got a Department of Energy loan for $500 million, and then the company went bankrupt. So the Republicans and the American Petroleum Institute and the fossil fuel industry are all saying, look, it's a waste of money to put money in this sort of thing, and what a scandal. None of them are saying that the same government agency that did that spent 20 times as much on this MOX fuel plant, okay, which will never operate. And it got so bad and so embarrassing for the government because they didn't have any potential clients for this plant, including the Tennessee River Authority, which is the U.S. government, that they actually made a deal with one of their contractors saying, if you buy a utility and give them a contract and then have them buy MOX fuel from this new facility, we'll give you the contract to run the Savannah River site. I mean, that's how bad it is here. So, and President Obama's record in this area is horrendous. It's terrible. And the Department of State, which pushed this whole MOX thing for peace, has no idea what to do now. This was the plan for demilitarizing nuclear weapons. This was the plan for getting rid of them. Well, the plan doesn't work. So what's the next step? Bob Alvarez, who worked for the Department of Energy, and Senator Glenn, and was one of the guys who helped open up the Department of Energy and the nuclear testing and all the rest of it, said that his suggestion would be just to put the stuff in glass and get rid of it. It's very hard for governments that think that they can make a lot of money off of this to do that. The Russians can't even abide by the idea. The French are just realizing that the French government owns 85% of Areva, which is a company which is doomed because it's put all its efforts in this technology. And the British just closed their reprocessing plant that was the great victory of the Margaret Thatcher regime at Sellafield. So now the Japanese people in government have to make some decisions. It's going to take them a long time to get off of nuclear power. They have so much invested in it. But the country is so small in area that another accident could be just devastating. So, and because of the geological and weather and all the other problems that you have in Japan, I mean, this kind of activity is just foolhardy. Also, there's another thing. Up until the accidents of the Japanese facilities in the 90s, we thought the Japanese were sort of bulletproof on this stuff, that they really knew how to handle this stuff. It was the same arrogance that we saw in the U.S. space program before we lost Challenger. It was the same sort of arrogance you just get with technology when you get used to it. Well, now we know differently. So do you want to engage in activities with a technology that potentially is so catastrophic? Now, yes, coal kills people. You breathe coal and you're going to die. It gives mercury poisoning to children. It does all kinds of bad things. But it doesn't spread cancer on a mass scale instantaneously. And these are the sorts of – there are trade-offs on every kind of fuel, every kind of effort you make. But that's something that should be decided publicly by the population of these countries. And also, in the case of nuclear, it is worldwide. It's not something limited to Japan's borders. I mean, it was interesting. The story broke over here just this week that half the radiation detectors in the United States were out that EPA should have had up and running during Fukushima. So, you know, this is the kind of thing, and it was that really reminded me of the period after Chernobyl. It may turn out that Fukushima is far worse than Chernobyl. We still have to see what happens to reactor number 4. I don't think anybody quite believes that there's a handle on the situation yet, not really. And we have to wait and see. But the reality is, during that period, the Japanese people are entitled to know. The United States has a very short memory. We had a reactor accident. We were very lucky. And we stopped building reactors for a long time. Now we've just commissioned two more in right 10 miles from the Savannah River site, in an area called Cancer Alley down in Georgia, South Carolina border. So we don't seem to have learned our lesson, but the companies that build them have learned their lesson because they're being funded by the U.S. government.
Well, some very sobering assessments, but it's best that the public does know about it. So Joseph Trento, my hat's off to you for this incredible story. I hope people will go see it at dcbureau.org, and thank you once again for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.